Well, college is challenging to everyone, I think, but it's especially so for many first-generation students. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Our next guest has spent much of her career focusing on access to higher education for students from low-income families, first-generation college students, students who are historically underrepresented in American high education or higher education settings. With us, Dr. Rutanatip Chunwarawong. She's, I hope I pronounced it close, her friends call her and family members sometimes call her Dr. Ding. She's currently a senior consultant for Arradondo Advisory Group, a DEI consultancy. And we're going to talk with her about what it's like to be a first-generation college student. And certainly, I hope you join in. Were you the first in your family to go to college? What did it mean for your family? What difficulties did you have? Love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Ding, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Mueller. I'm like starstruck right now because I get to be talking to you. This is like, oh my God.
Well, I tell you what, I hope I didn't completely butcher your name. And it's certainly, I tried and I, you know, my own name, the last name is spelled Mueller. And it when I started on radio, my mother said, good, now people will maybe be able to pronounce my last name. But still, I get Mueller, Mailer, Myler, Mueller, Miller.
And I must confess, I had to call my host family, whose last name is Miller, to ask them how to pronounce your last name.
Well, it's Mueller.
So, yes, I got Mueller, and hopefully I don't mess up. And thank you again for having me. And you did pronounce my name very well, better than my husband.
Well, let's talk. You were a first-generation college student, were you not?
Yes, yes. My father is a son of Chinese immigrants to Thailand. So I'm like immigrants in many generations. But his family immigrated from Guangdong, from China to Thailand in the 1930s. And my mom's side immigrated to Thailand early on. So we Chinese in Thailand. And then my dad only have fourth grade education. And my mom finished college. Fortunately, my dad worked really hard. My parents worked really hard. And my dad had many, many jobs, from raising pig to he was a tailor. He was a taxi driver. He was a hotel owner, a car dealership owner, until when he retired at in his 80s, he was a gas station and many other business owner.
Well, and with the fourth grade, my dad had an eighth grade education and had to go back to the farm. So and couldn't go on. My mother did make it through high school. What was the experience like as a college student, though, from a first-generation family?
I think in Thailand, I must say that I grew up in Thailand, and I didn't come to this country until I was 21. So it was, you know, in Thailand, there was not a lot of obstacle, I would say, because financially, we were doing well, and most of my friends were in the same socioeconomic status in a private school in Thailand, and then I went to college in Thailand. I think the differences came when I came to America, and this layer of identities, right, that came together from being, I was an international student, didn't speak English very well. I was a first generation college student, although my sister did went to college and had graduate degree. We weren't really close, but she was able to help me navigate this country somewhat. And then to be also a foreigner, right? And not an American in this country. So that's sort of its layer of identities and barriers, but also things that I thought were, I came with advantages that were not necessary to my advantage when I came to America, like my accent, you know, my ability to speak different languages, or the fact that I look different, that I never thought that, you know, I never thought about being an Asian before, for example. And that's play a role in it. But it's, you know, you can feel in college that there are people who know about the world and also literatures and cultures more than I did, and still more than I do, right? So there's, you know, privilege and oppression go both ways, right? As they somehow, it depends on context.
Yeah. Why is it important in your mind for universities, colleges to bring in first generation students?
Because, well, you know, education, it's the key. Of course, I don't believe education is much as a great equalizer, but more of a tool for social mobility and a tool to help us have well-informed citizens. Right, for our society, for our future. And so it's important for us to create access for all students. And if they choose to come, the opportunity should be there. And that's what America is all about, right? It's a land of opportunity. So if opportunity is only available to certain people, but not all people, then it's not democracy. Then democracy is lopsided. So I think it's important, particularly for, you know, like the University of Wisconsin system, a public land-grant university, we need to provide access to everyone in the state. And if majority of our member of our states are people who do not have college degree and have kids, you know, who need access to learn more about anything they want to learn, they should have opportunity and access.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe talk a bit about and we'll have more time later after our news break, but what are some of the challenges first-generation students face that others don't, that other students don't? You've talked about a few of them in your circumstance, but others as well.
In my career, I work with mostly first-generation college students who also come from low-income families. And that's include former foster youth students. That's include, you know, first generation graduate students and students from different racial background. And when race and class come together as, you know, as barrier, oftentimes that's come with lack of opportunity and exposure to things like traveling, right? As kids growing up, traveling around the country or outside the country. Access to, have family who live outside of Madison, only 45 minutes outside of Madison. And in those towns, public library are not the same. We can say that, right? They're not like as robust as Madison. Access to museums or resources that we have opportunity to participate in Madison or city like Milwaukee or Chicago. Students and kids in rural area Wisconsin don't have those opportunities. And those things compile and translate into how students can succeed in the educational system when they start school.
Dr. Dang, our guest today, we're talking with her about first-generation students for college. I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments as we move along. Were you a first-generation, or do you have children or friends of children who are first-generation? What are your thoughts? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back with Dr. Dang. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, college is challenging for everyone, but especially so, I think, for first-generation students. And we're talking about that today with Dr. Dang, who has spent much of her career focusing on access to higher education for students from low-income families, first-generation college students, students who are historically underrepresented in American higher education settings. And it's really great to have her with us to talk about this whole issue. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take some calls. Jeremy in Mineral Point, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, how y'all doing? Thank you for having me. Again, Jeremy from Mineral Point. And I just wanted to share, like, I was a college student who moved from Chicago to Southwest Wisconsin. And during my college days, I realized very early it was important to be able to speak to my poverty and race story. But it was also important to kind of ground that a bit, to be thinking about all the things I came to college with. I was backed by my caretakers, friends, community of moms and dads who poured so much into me. And so from that standpoint, I wasn't the first to go off to college, but I was the first backed by many. And I think it's important to expand the conversation like that. And then in addition to that, from a paradigm shift, thinking about being guided from a spiritual standpoint, I truly believe I'm guided by my ancestors, as well as the local ancestors on the lands in Platteville from Pleasant Ridge. I truly feel like, you know, that also helps to impact and influence the ways in which I navigated college. So my hope is that, you know, we can continue to talk about the challenges and issues, but also consider some of the paradigms and think about, you know, some of the things we come to college with in terms of assets for influence.
Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Dang, comments?
People would think I paid you to call because you hit on the point I want to make, I really want to make on this show, is that, you know, although first generation is a category, we are not monolithic, right? There's diversity within being first generation. And so that's one, you know, with race, class, gender, and everything else. But in addition, I wanted to make sure, as point to what Jeremy had said, that we don't forget what first-generation students bring with them to college. And I would say, you know, for being first-generation student myself, I brought with me persistent, hardworking, you know, I learned work ethics from my parents. I brought with me dreams, like big dreams about aspiration of what I could and could become. Also sense of curiosity, but most importantly, I think it's self-advocacy skill, because my parents, for example, not only they're first gen, they're not Americans. And I had to learn early on to navigate for myself, right? To ask questions, to not be shy, to even if I'm scared to death, I'm just gonna go and ask and make myself known to my professor or my friends. And ask to join their study group or ask for help in tutoring and things like that. So I really thank you for the point that you made, Jeremy. I really should be like taking you out for coffee for that.
Jeremy, thank you so much. Very well put. Thank you very much for calling. Dennis in Two Rivers, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. This reminds me of what's going on with Afghanistan, whether they're immigrants coming here or other countries or just staying in Afghanistan. There's so much limitation, and every limitation to whether it's formal education or the internet or libraries, it limits the opportunities for the rest of us. Because if opportunities would be like a building, each person could either add to the structure or add to what's necessary to maintain the structure and enhance it.
Interesting thought. Dr. Dan, comment.
Yes, I think that instead of looking at, you know, a person like war refugee, for example, Hmong, Vietnamese, Cambodian, or Afghanistan, so people from other country in the deficit, right? We need to look at what skills they brought already and how do we build upon those strengths and help them find, for example, cultural connection and connecting point, right? Because my example is when I came here, I was fortunate enough to live with an American host family who were complete stranger who kindly took me in and show me how to take the buses in Madison, how to, you know, dress for the winter, the things that you would think I would know, take, you know, that I took for granted, right? And even introduced me to NPR, WPR, and listening to things that go on around America, so I can have conversation that sound like I know something about America. But it's also helped me with my English, for instance. And those are the cultural connection that people make, relationship that people make to help bring strength, you know, off of one another.
You worked at the University of Wisconsin for many years in different roles, supporting students from low-income families, as we talked about, the first-generation college students and so forth. How does the University of Wisconsin, or how do universities help students in these situations?
In many ways, with, you know, scholarship, for example, the late Chancellor Banks had, you know, established scholarship for low-income and first-generation students in terms of access with different pre-college programs and undergraduate programs, as well as fellowship for graduate students, for example, not specifically on being low-income or first-generation, but those things are taken into considerations. And also many faculty work with program, like I directed a program funded by the federal government, started from President Johnson era, War on Poverty, the TRIO program for 14 years. And I collaborate extensively with many faculty who want to take a look at that curriculum to make that curriculum more diverse, you know, and inclusive of all students, but particularly to help encourage first generation college students to think of many possibilities, like graduate school, introducing them to research, introducing them to professions that they have never thought about before, in fields that they probably have never heard of, like my parents would still don't understand what I do for a job. You know, they still don't know. I have a PhD and 5 degrees, but my parents do not understand a thing about my degree. They just know I have a job, and that's a good thing. I have a job. And that's an example, right, of what university can do to help with career development, with connecting to parents and community in different languages, like Spanish and Hmong, and to help parents also understand career path and academic interests of their students.
Yeah. I was thinking about my own role. Over the years, I advised hundreds of students as an advisor along with teaching classes. And I many, many times worked with first-generation students. And I like to think I was respectful but and also helpful in getting them through even not necessarily even coursework kinds of things, but other financial and other kinds of issues that they might have had. And I think advisors can play a, or did do play a very important role.
Yes, definitely. For, you know, guiding students on the different, it's complicated. We make things so complicated for students in general, not just first generation students. But when students have, for example, my kids have me, you know, that they can come and ask. My husband is the principal. They can also ask him. He's gone to college. But think of people who do not have people at home to ask, and they don't know who to ask, right? In terms of how to pay bills, school bills, or how to fill out financial aid, or what does it mean with all these different majors and certificates and double majors and all those things that, oh, and then can I fit study abroad? Can I go to study abroad and pay for it? How does it count for my degree? That's what we have wonderful advisor on campus that and programs like the TRIO Student Support Services Program, for example, such as, you know, that funded by the federal government to help our students navigate our complicated higher education system.
So we may have and probably do have parents listening who want their children to attend college, haven't experienced it themselves. What advice or tips do you have for those parents?
I would say tap into definitely school counselors are really overworked, you know, they overload, but there are community organizations and a lot of programs to support K-12 students, including the Boys and Girls Club, the Urban League, you know, there's community organizations and the Central Hispano that help students, that can help them match with mentor, can help them match with pre-college program. My son was a part of AVID program from middle school to high school. And they did college. He had the opportunity to do college tour, many university around the Midwest, learn about college requirements through those program. But at the same time, doing that with cohort of peers, right? That he can connect with and possibly walk through this path with without being, you know, feeling like he is alone. And definitely there's a lot of resources in our community. Do not be shy to ask for support. And I know schools can be tough right now because they understaff, you know, in the K-12, but there are a lot of resources out there that could support both parents and the students.
You know, I almost even hate to bring it up in a way, but when students drop out or we lose some of those, typically what are the reasons that something like that happens?
Typically, when students drop out, it's less likely to be about academics or GPA. It's more about sense of belonging. It's about them don't feel connected to the campus that they are at, feel like they are alone, or feel that they don't have destination or purpose, right? They can't find what they want to study or their own passion. And it's less likely to be because they're not ready. Because university don't admit students who academically not ready. Right? They're usually ready, but there's the emotional side to all of us about how vulnerable we are, you know, as a person, as a first gen, maybe as a woman, as an immigrant, as somebody like me, and, you know, I was an international student. So there's a lot, there's pieces of us that make us sort of alone, feel alone, right? And not connecting. And so in research have shown, you know, students feel isolated in that classroom in particular. They don't feel like they connect with anybody in the classroom and feeling alone, that they are more likely to drop out.
I can remember I taught quite a few semesters of a course. There was a group of students that would be joined together as freshmen, and they would be enrolled in the same classes.
Yep.
Together. Talk about that as a way to help.
Yes, many universities, including UW-Madison, has what's called first-year interest group, and those have fascinating topics. I want to take them all, but they are basically built, you know, to connect some of the core classes together to help students make sense of what they are learning and how they connect it together. For example, psychology and biology and math together. And why are those three things are important, and under a theme of perhaps, I can't think of a theme right now. Let's just say, you know, saving the world from, you know, global warming or something like that. But so it's give them purpose, right? Of meanings of why I'm taking all these random classes, but they're actually not random. They're connected somehow. And then I'm with friends, I'm with peer that I see regularly, and I'm mentoring by a faculty member who signed up to do this, to work together, collaborate and coordinate their classes so that the things that students learn during their first year make sense in the bigger picture, and they get the big idea, basically.
Yeah, I thought it was a great way because those students, because they were in the same classes at the same time, I noted that they became friends as the semester went along. Or, I mean, it was their first time around in courses. And so they had some peer group developments.
Yes. Yep.
That were, to me, were about as important as anything.
Yes. And that's most important. And some of those freshman interest group are held and connected into the living spaces that they are in, meaning the dorm, the resident hall, which is even, you know, really cool because you can go to class in your pajamas. As parents, I don't want to think about it. But how fun is it to go to classes in pajamas and with coffee with friends, you know, and learn about world issues and things you never thought you would learn about?
So you've obviously, you've had all these years of experiences. What are some of the changes you noticed between the freshman and sophomore years with these first-in-the-family students?
I think that students gain confidence if they experience success after their first year. You know, success by that, I mean they made friends. They found connection, meaningful connection on campus, whether it would be with, particularly, I would say, with faculty member, with key, some two or three peers, maybe, and found sort of area of interest they want to explore, right? And then students starting to gain more confidence when they move on into their sophomore year to think about, you know, maybe I do belong here. And there are things I wanted to look into more and classes I want to explore, but particularly there are people who care about me. There are faculty that I could visit during office hours, faculty who taught, you know, big class, like the bulk class, entomology, or the zoology class, that care about a teaching assistant, I should not forget to mention them, or advisor who care about who I am as a person and what I'm interested in, and able to connect me with the things that I'm interested in to help me grow.
I remember a student telling me once who decided to major in my department, who said to me what impressed her was that I was the first professor who actually addressed her by her first name, knew her name.
Yes, and that's made all the difference, right? And when I was at UW, I went to undergraduate at UW-Platteville, I remember I always missed the 7:30 a.m. classes because it was so cold. And I'm like, who would go in the dark and cold? And this faculty actually called me at my dorm. He called and he said, where have you been? You haven't been to classes. And I thought, oh my God, I better get there. But that's matter, is that there's someone who recognized me as a person, and not just, you know, the massive 500 people lecture in the lecture and not care who I am and how I'm doing. But that person that made connection with me and realized that I need help.
Yeah, that's, I can think of many experiences like that among faculty. Another colleague, another student told me that she, another member of our faculty, she wound up in the hospital sick, and he actually went to the hospital and visited her in the hospital, and made such a huge impression on her. It's a wonderful experience, that personal touch.
Yes.
So here we got about 30 seconds to go. Any final words for those first-gen parents or students?
And that you're not alone. And you know, many of us who work on colleges and university faculty and advisor and staff, we are first gen too. And we're there to help. And they, you know, students may feel lost. They need encouragement. They need people to believe in them. And we're there. Right now, my colleagues at all kinds of university across the country are ready to help and ready to support them.
Dr. Dang, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it, and I hope we have a chance to do this again. Thank you.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Dr. Dang, senior consultant at Arredondo Advisory Group, worked for many years at the University of Wisconsin in that same capacity of working with those young students. She did a wonderful job. Thanks to her, and thanks to you for listening. And stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.